This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 3, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. President Bush appoints his former personal attorney, Harriet Myers, to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. Three coordinated bombing attacks strike Bali, killing dozens and injuring over 100 people. And commemorative marches in Mexico this weekend mark the country's continued state of impunity. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Palestinian parliament has voted to urge President Mahmoud Abbas to dissolve his cabinet for failing to manage factional violence in the wake of Israel's pullout from the Gaza Strip. The vote comes after armed clashes on Sunday between Palestinian police and members of the armed resistance group Hamas, which killed three Palestinians, including a police commander. Each party has blamed the other for initiating the conflict. Abbas is walking a political tightrope, trying to show Israel that he can maintain calm in Palestinian-controlled territory while trying to convince armed resistance groups that he's making progress toward ending the Israeli occupation. Zahed Banoura is a news editor at the International Middle East Media Center Project. He says Abbas needs to find a way to end the internal clashes without stirring up resentment by suppressing armed groups.
The last thing we need here in the area is an internal fight, an escalating violence inside the Palestinian area between the Palestinian factions themselves.
Al Jazeera reports that after Sunday's violence, the leaders of several armed resistance groups agreed to end clashes in the streets. But today, dozens of Palestinian Authority police officers stormed Gaza's parliament building to demand a crackdown on Hamas. Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers arrested dozens of Palestinians in early morning raids today. Israel claims they're involved with armed groups. Palestinian activists say they're mostly political leaders, and Israel is trying to weaken Hamas going into this winter's Palestinian elections. In Luxembourg today, foreign ministers of the European Union reached an agreement which will allow membership talks with Turkey to proceed. The negotiations were nearly derailed by objections from Austria's right-wing government. Tony Cross has more from Paris.
The opening ceremony for EU-Turkey talks in Luxembourg was held up for hours as the Europeans wrangled over the wording of the document, which will be the basis for negotiations. Austria eventually dropped its objections and its proposal that Turkey might become a privileged partner rather than a fully-fledged member. European opponents to Turkish membership range from Islamophobes to human rights advocates to workers worried about cheap labour. The pro-Turkish camp includes bosses who think that cheap labour is a good idea, as well as those who want to see the EU expand as a free trade area all around the Mediterranean Sea. They argue that bringing Turkey in will send a positive message to the Islamic world, although this argument might seem strange coming from the current president of the EU. Britain enthusiastically took part in the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
This week, the first civil union law created by a state legislature takes effect. Now same-sex couples in Connecticut can enjoy all the rights, obligations, and benefits of marriage. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
Though gay rights advocates see Connecticut's civil unions law as a compromise that falls short of legalizing same-sex marriage, they're happy to chalk it up as a victory. Representative Mike Lawler helped move the bill through the General Assembly.
It's really marriage by another name. Unfortunately, the Connecticut civil union is not recognized by any other state or by the federal government. But the same is the case for the same-sex marriages from Massachusetts.
Ann Standback, director of Love Makes a Family, says the new law will provide protections same-sex couples need. She also says her organization will keep working for gay marriage.
I think that we will see a lot of progress in the next year as people realize that this doesn't affect them. It only adds more security to couples who need these protections.
Standback says some couples whose town halls opened on Saturday have already entered civil unions. Many others will do so this week. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's proposal for electoral reform has drawn calls for mass protest from the country's left-wing parties, who say the changes would stack the deck against them going into this spring's election. Diletta Varlese reports from Italy.
The proposed electoral reform would change the rules just 7 months before Italy's next round of national elections. Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's ruling right-wing coalition is trailing badly in polls, but critics say the new proportional representation rules will strengthen his position. That's because they favor big parties and will cut off some small left-wing parties, weakening the main opposition coalition named L'Unione or the Union. Romano Prodi, leader of L'Unione and the leading candidate for president in spring 2006, is denouncing the change as undemocratic. He says such sweeping changes should not be made without dialogue in parliament or a public consultation. In fact, a popular referendum in 1993 created Italy's current electoral system. Demonstrations against the reform are planned for the coming days in Rome. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese from Italy.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tickert for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush nominated his former personal attorney, Harriet Myers, this morning to replace Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. Myers has never served as a judge, and little is known about her public record. Ingrid Drake reports from Washington, D.C.
She's a very nice, courteous, non-confrontational person.
New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer, a member of the Judiciary Committee, does not know much about the public record of Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers.
We know less about this nominee than we knew about John Roberts. And because this nomination is for the swing seat on the Supreme Court, it means learning the nominee's judicial philosophy is going to be even more important than it was for John Roberts.
The Texas-born Myers has served as President Bush's personal attorney since the 1970s and joined the Bush White House as staff in 2000.
If confirmed, I recognize that I will have a tremendous responsibility to keep our judicial system strong and to help ensure that the courts meet their obligations to strictly apply the laws and the Constitution.
Prior to assisting the president, Myers served for 5 years as the head of the Texas Lottery Commission. These experiences will serve Myers well as a Supreme Court justice, says President Bush.
She has a record of achievement in the law, as well as experience as an elected member of the Dallas City Council. She served at high levels of both state and federal government. Before state and federal courts, she had tried cases and argued appeals that covered a broad range of matters.
While Senator Arlen Specter, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, would like to see Myers confirmed by Thanksgiving, Senator Schumer says the process will depend on the White House's willingness to release all relevant documents about Myers. Schumer also says there should be no rush because a rigorous and comprehensive questioning of Myers is needed.
There are two ways to find out what her judicial philosophy is, her past record, and, you know, her record as lottery commissioner isn't going to tell us very much. So it would be the time she served in the White House, although it was rather small. But if there ever was a time when the hearings are going to make a huge difference, it's now.
Today also marked the first day Justice John Roberts presided over the Supreme Court. This session, the court will hear cases on whether colleges can bar military recruiters and the legality of parental consent laws for abortion. While more than 100 members of the Christian Defense Force prayed at the court steps for the end of legal abortions in the U.S., Bill Persaud, with Legal Momentum, a women's legal rights organization, says pro-choice voices must also be heard.
I think the steps of the Capitol are an excellent place for an open protest. But inside the Supreme Court, that is the place where we need to hear diverse voices. That is why we need to know more about the president's nominee.
In the early 1990s, Myers led a campaign to get the American Bar Association to reverse its position on upholding Roe v. Wade. Approximately 40 male and female members of Planned Parenthood also held a demonstration in front of the White House, asking Myers to clearly state her position on reproductive rights. The Senate Judiciary Committee has not yet scheduled confirmation hearings for Myers. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Three near-simultaneous suicide bomb attacks exploded in two coffee shops and one restaurant in Bali over the weekend. 27 people have been reported killed and more than 100 injured. The Saturday night bombings were the second since the 2002 attack claimed 202 lives, most of them Australian. Indonesian government officials say they suspect that two Malaysians, Dr. Azari and Nurdin Mohtab, masterminded the attack. The two are suspected to be members of Jamaah Islamiyah, an al-Qaeda cell in Southeast Asia. From Jakarta, Maggie Margiono has more.
Police screened an amateur video recording of Saturday's suicide bombing in Bali. A young man wearing blue jeans and a black t-shirt is shown carrying a bomb concealed within a backpack into a coffee shop. A few seconds later, the bomb rips through the cafe. Indonesian police say they have released gruesome photos of the bombers' heads to help in their investigation. Police spokesman Anang Budiharjo.
We are furthering this investigation to get the identities of these three people. We are looking for the others beside these three.
Following the September 11th attacks, several suicide bombings occurred in Indonesia, one of them in Bali 3 years ago, that claimed more than 200 lives. Many were tourists and most were Australians. This year, Indonesia further developed its anti-terrorism efforts. Backed by the U.S. and Australia, Indonesia set up an international crime center, the main focus of which is to combat terrorism. According to Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, aside from developing international cooperation, Indonesia needs to improve its national security system.
Terrorism is truly a challenge, not only against Indonesian nations, but also against all nations of the world. Aside from requests for international cooperation, which we have fulfilled, surely we alone have to develop actions for national security.
In addition to the injuries and loss of life, the attacks delivered a major PR blow to the idea that a military presidency in Indonesia makes the country more secure against a terrorist attack. The government has also massively campaigned that Bali is now safe from terror attacks. Michael Swain is a U.S. national who survived Saturday night's bombing. He was on holiday with his family when the attack occurred.
I was screaming to see if my mom and all my family is okay. I was really scared to death, seriously. This is the first time in my life I ever got a bomb threat. I don't want this to happen again. It's really painful.
Indonesia's Muslim communities expressed their disapproval of the attacks and asked that the government not associate acts of terrorism with Islam. Reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta, I'm Monica Lopez for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. Army recruitment efforts fell 7,000 recruits short of its 2005 goal, according to reports marking the end of the fiscal year on Sunday. Recruiters faced their worst shortfall since 1979, with a downward trend which continued from last year and appears will prolong into 2006. Meanwhile, students protesting military recruitment on college campuses were assaulted in at least three incidents over the past week. Darby Hickey reports from Fairfax, Virginia, where a student was arrested for expressing his views at George Mason University.
This is not just a couple of dumb cops. This is systematic. This is happening all over the country.
George Mason University student Tariq Khan spoke today to a rally of over 100 students on the university campus, detailing his experience last Thursday of being arrested after protesting military recruitment on campus. Khan, who served 4 years in the Air Force, was standing near a table of military recruiters handing out anti-war pamphlets he had written himself, as he often does at this Northern Virginia university. He was first harassed by other students, then assaulted and arrested by a campus police officer.
I was charged with trespassing and disorderly conduct, and while the police and vigilantes were brutalizing me, other right-wing students were cheering them on, shouting, kick his ass, as any witnesses can attest to. This is the climate that we're going to school in. This is not a learning environment. This is a police state. Politicians said that they had to send troops to Iraq and Afghanistan to liberate the Middle East, while we don't even have something as fundamental as freedom of speech on our own college campuses.
Khan says he was subject to racist insults and threats while in police custody. George Mason University President Alan Merton has released a statement about the event, which student Golnasa Moshri read at the rally.
A student protesting the war in Iraq was allegedly stripped of a protest sign, was asked to leave the building, and was later arrested. George Mason University reiterates its deep commitment to the freedom of speech. we must work to avoid attacks on expressions of free speech, including destruction of signs and other written statements. Disagreements about exactly what occurred are inevitable, and the university is not currently in a position to establish responsibilities.
At the rally this afternoon, Tariq Khan connected his experience to attacks on student activists at other campuses. He recounted a story which occurred the same day as his arrest. At Holyoke Community College in Massachusetts, police violently broke up a student picket of an Army National Guard recruiting table. And in Madison, the day before incidents in Virginia and Massachusetts, University of Wisconsin students were threatened with arrest if they continued to protest CIA and military recruiters at their school's job fair. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey.
Sunday marked the 37th anniversary of one of the most notorious massacres in modern Mexico. This year, the annual nationwide commemorative marches took place in the context of failed attempts to put ex-officials on trial for alleged ties to the slaughter. As Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca, the 2nd of October has now come to symbolize the climate of impunity in Mexico.
On October 2nd of 1968, hundreds of people, mostly striking students, were gunned down during a demonstration in downtown Mexico City. The student demonstration came just days before Mexico hosted the 1968 Olympics. The Mexican government, then led by the PRI party, accused the students of provoking a confrontation. The massacre was a watershed moment in contemporary Mexico and represents the beginning of what is now referred to as the Dirty War. Raúl Álvarez Garín participated in the student strike in 1968 and is now the coordinator of Comité 68, a group seeking justice for victims of the Dirty War.
No solamente es el caso del 2 de octubre de 68. Algo semejante ocurrió el 10 de junio.
It's not just the case of October 2, 1968. Something similar happened on June 10, 1971, when a student demonstration was also brutally attacked, resulting in dozens of deaths. October 2nd of 68, June 10th of 71, and the hundreds of disappeared, registered during the late 70s and up through the early 80s, are the actions for which we are demanding that the authorities stand trial for genocide.
Every October 2nd, marches throughout Mexico commemorate the massacre. Yesterday, demonstrations took place in six cities. This student participated in the commemorative march in Oaxaca City, a demonstration marked by an exaggerated police presence, about four police for each protester.
All of us who come to march come from humble, poor origins. And regardless, those who are following us with machine guns also come from poor backgrounds. But unlike past years, the repression here today has no limits in the state of Oaxaca.
Vicente Fox's election to the presidency ended 71 years of one-party rule in Mexico. Many had hoped that ex-government officials implicated in the Dirty War would be held accountable for their actions. In 2001, President Fox appointed a special prosecutor to investigate political crimes of the past. Human rights attorney Jessica Sanchez explains what has happened to prosecute ex-officials for student massacres and hundreds of cases of forced disappearances.
Nothing happened. White elephants were created, like the Office of the Special Prosecutor for Social Movements and Political Crimes of the Past. These offices have really served to demonstrate the lack of political will to deal with the most basic things. Really, it has stalled a series of investigations. It has even exercised penal actions after statutes have expired, basic details that indicate that it's not effective. It has even appeared to obstruct justice by announcing who they are going to obtain when, in order to give those people time to organize appeals.
Ex-President Luis Echeverría was virtually absolved by a federal judge this year of any responsibility for two student massacres. Massacre survivors and family members of those killed or disappeared during the Dirty War are seeking a political trial of the federal judge and are appealing the decision to international bodies. Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News, Oaxaca.
Just south of the U.S.-Mexico border, Tijuana is home to about 2 million people. 125,000 Mexicans work in foreign-owned factories or maquiladoras there. A group of women is now demanding compensation in court for unpaid severance and overtime pay from U.S.-owned Cardinal Health, a company that in 2003 made gross earnings of $285 million. Combined, the six women are asking for about $100,000 in damages. In Tijuana, Miles Ashdown has more.
In 2004, Cardinal Health bought Alaris Medical Systems Maquiladora and decided to move that factory to the outskirts of the city, where public transportation is expensive. They gave the employees two options: work at the new industrial park or resign and give up seniority and severance rights. 40-year-old Alejandra Montez, a mother of three, worked in the old factory for 10 years. She decided to fight for her rights guaranteed in Mexican labor laws along with five other women. They are demanding their legally guaranteed compensation. Montez said what Cardinal Health did was abusive.
That made me feel really mad. The company wanted us to support them, but the company didn't support us when we needed it.
At a hearing last Thursday, Cardinal Health lawyers made a new offer, but Jaime Cota, a legal advisor for the workers, said it was not meaningful. He said the company's legal case is completely destroyed.
The
maquiladoras are not used to facing a real serious legal defense of the workers. They usually expect that the workers' lawyers are corrupt and will accept any money from the company in order to get some profit. So they're perplexed in this case, and that's an advantage for us.
Another advantage is the falsification by Cardinal Health of the workers' initial contract from 1994. The document said the workers knew the company would move in 2004 to the new location, but at that time the industrial park didn't even exist.
And during that time, it was just grass for cows, and the title of the property during this time didn't allow the construction of factories. So, and supposedly the worker signed this document. So it's ridiculous.
Enrique Davalos, an activist at the Workers' Information Center in Tijuana, has been assisting the workers in this struggle. He says Cardinal Health is using this case as an example for other workers to not stand up for their rights.
It's not only that they don't want to spend the money, but also they want to maintain a general policy in the maquiladoras in Mexico that the labor law is not going to be respected. That is saving a lot of money to the companies, not only to Cardinal Health, but that all the maquiladoras who are operating in the Mexico-U.S. border.
In San Antonio, Texas, Marta Ojeda, the executive director of the Coalition for Justice in the Maquiladoras, agrees. Her organization strives to improve working and living standards for maquiladora workers by organizing and educating communities in Mexico and the United States.
We need to educate the people in the United States, because if you send letters, if you make pressure in the United States to these corporations, it's the only way that they listen, because you are the consumers. Right here in Mexico, there is a lot of corruption and the authorities labor, and there is a lot of impunity because they say that the corporations are providing jobs and we don't have to disturb them and anything. So the only ones who are paying the consequences are the workers.
Workers like Susana Martinez, who is also fighting the legal battle against Cardinal Health. She, too, worked at the Maquiladora for 10 years and has been without a job now for the duration of the legal battle, more than a year.
Because I've not been able to get any stable work since I have to get permission to go to these court cases, and it's tough to find a factory that will allow me to go.
Legal advisor Jaime Coda doesn't expect the case to end anytime soon. He said because of corruption, the labor board will likely rule against the workers, but they'll appeal to a Supreme Court. Coda said ultimately this is just a small struggle. In the coming years, he expects workers will amass and fight against injustice in the maquiladoras. In Tijuana, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal comments on Bill Bennett's remarks last week when he stated that crime would be eradicated if all black babies were aborted.
Hypothetical holocausts?
You could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down.
The words of conservative pundit and former Reagan-era education secretary Bill Bennett, that the nation's crime problem could be solved if all black babies were aborted is the echo in the hearts of white America, voiced by a man who has made his post-government career as a moralist. Already, so-called black conservatives are marched out to defend their colleagues' words, with some saying it is a mere hypothetical, an intellectual mind game, according to one Negro neocon. These words, coming in the shadow of the vast government malfeasance and indeed betrayals that lay at the heart of Hurricane Katrina, where people, predominantly black people, were left to drown and starve by the tens of thousands, show that the space between hypothetical and real is thin indeed. While the rapper Kanye West is condemned by the white nationalist corporate media for daring to say that President Bush doesn't care about black people, Bennett's far more pernicious comments, which call for a kind of compassionate mass killing, are defended by Republicans, ignored by most white Democrats, and blithely poo-pooed by the White House. As for the corporate media, once again, in the rush to be first, it sent out hours of reports of Hurricane Katrina that were based on rumors and lies, lies spun by police and politicians, while cops staged organized looting parties if they stayed in New Orleans at all. Reports of mass rapes and mounds of murder victims at the Superdome and the Convention Center, dutifully transmitted to millions of viewers, listeners, and readers, fed into the fears of a nation already preconditioned to dread and fear black people and the specter of black crime. Such lies, such racist imagery, allowed nearby communities to literally close their borders to blacks trying to escape the rising waters at gunpoint. Cops in Gretna, Louisiana, charged black men, women, and children trying to cross the bridge out of the sunken city, firing at them. They later took their little food and water. It is not surprising that Bennett's words come mere weeks after Katrina. Was he not part of the first American presidency that went to shed tears at a Nazi cemetery in Bitburg, Germany? There is not a Holocaust in human history that didn't begin with hypothetical or intellectual mind games. Indeed, when Turkey was busy massacring the Armenians, U.S. High Commissioner to Turkey, Admiral Mark Bristol, a notorious bigot, was performing a mind game that would soon mean peril for Jews in Europe. Bristol wrote, "The Armenians are a race like the Jews. They have little or no national spirit and poor moral character." There is, in American political life, a deep abiding spirit of fascism formed around the kernel of white supremacy. It made the unspoken holocausts of so-called Indians possible, which in turn led to a new holocaust against Africans. That is the mother's milk of the nation and still governs popular and political thought. We saw its face in governmental neglect in Katrina. Bill Bennett, the nation's moralist, is its voice. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WPFW in Washington, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Headlines editor is Leanne Caldwell. Today's Washington editor is Selena Masuta. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.